Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Last One Walking, The Life of Cherokee Community Leader Charlie Soap, by Greg Shaw. Prologue by Wilma Mankiller. Afterword by Charlie Soap. Narrated by Kaipo Schwab. With joy you will draw water. Isaiah chapter 12. Verse 3. He was a tall, handsome man, whose sensitivity was threaded with ancestral love. He came from tribal leaders who had the humility and heart to lead through the most difficult striving. He was water. Joy Harjo, poet warrior. She also told me always to get to the water. You have to have water to keep going. Margaret Verbal, Stealing. Preface. The book Charlie and I have written together anticipates two audiences. The first consists of those already familiar with Native American history and contemporary indigenous issues. This audience knows the story of Wilma Mankiller, the first woman to serve as principal chief of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. They know it, but they would like to go deeper. The second audience is unfamiliar with this history, but they are curious about leadership and open to learning more about tribal communities. For those who may have followed the career of Chief Mankiller, this book offers a mostly untold perspective, that of her husband, partner, and the first gentleman of the Cherokee Nation, Charlie Soap. He is consequential in his own right, and he now brings us into his life and their life together as tribal and community leaders. Those who are new to the story will discover an inspiring, brilliant man who is the embodiment of Cherokee history and tradition, someone fully capable of introducing his tribe, its values, and challenges. Charlie and Wilma, together, helped Cherokee people help themselves, and they helped to build empathy for poor people by building something tangible, community water lines and housing. Listeners new to this material may encounter terms that are unfamiliar and even uncomfortable. What is the Trail of Tears? Or the author uses the labels Indian, Native American, and Indigenous throughout the book. Is that okay, you might ask? What about First Peoples and First Nations? All good questions. For this book, I use the terms that Charlie and other Cherokee people use. I use them with great humility and respect. For these listeners, there is already a robust bookshelf to help answer these questions of identity and identification, and I encourage them to explore it. Perhaps this book will be a launching point. Charlie asked me to tell his story. I am a white writer who has known poverty personally. I have worked with Charlie for 40 years, and I am honored that he asked me. I believe that it is my responsibility to write his story to the best of my ability. To accomplish this, we spent extensive time together in the 1980s and enjoyed many hours, weeks, and months together in the 2020s in interviews that I recorded digitally or noted by hand. Our story covers a lot of ground. Three distinct voices converge in the writing that follows: Wilma Mankiller's, Charlie Soap's, and my own. I have elected to have Wilma and Charlie speak for themselves. I prioritize their words whenever possible as they wrote or said them. That is why I employ extensive quotations from their writing and speeches in this work. Following Wilma's death in 2010, I received from Charlie faxed copies of Wilma's typewritten drafts of her manuscript. In 2021, I found another copy in a barn on Wilma's property at Mankiller Flats. With the help of others, I've carefully and sparingly edited her work and presented here as the prologue. I felt strongly that it should be preserved largely as she wrote it. Charlie's stories of experiences during the Vietnam War, his spirituality, and his early engagement with community development are for him to tell. I have listened, summarized, and consulted Charlie at every step. I did that decades ago during my Cub reporting days in the 1980s, and I have continued that tradition in these later years. The third voice is mine, and it reflects someone who began as an empathetic young man and evolved to become a more informed, hopefully wiser, older man. If the transition between voices is less than smooth at times, so be it. Sequoyah, creator of the Cherokee written language, described the English documents he saw in the early 1800s as talking leaves. Writing paper, or goeli in Cherokee, is suggestive of a leaf, in Sequoyah's parlance. In that spirit, Wilma, Charlie, and I are like talking leaves, individual but flowering from and reliant on the same tree. I took on this project with the greatest respect one person can have for another. My aim is to present the story of a man's life, a life that is distant to many, yet essential to understanding, or at least beginning to understand, Native American culture. Our story presents Charlie's family life, his formative years in the U.S. Navy, his spiritual development, and his dedication to serving Cherokee people in some of the poorest communities in America. Our book profiles my friend Charlie Soap, and it celebrates the Cherokee principle of Gadugi. Translated from Cherokee, Gadugi means collective work for the common good. Charlie often describes it to mean help one another. Over centuries, it has been a distinguishing characteristic of the Cherokee people. Cherokee and non-Cherokee authors have commented on its meaning. The Finnish historian Pekka Hämäläinen writes in Indigenous Continent, The Epic Contest for North America, that the Cherokees long practiced a strong communitarian ethos. He specifically notes that Gadugi pervaded the Cherokee world. Novelist and citizen of the Cherokee Nation, Margaret Verbal and I, exchanged emails in 2023 after she published Stealing, the story of a young Cherokee girl that has been compared with To Kill a Mockingbird. The novel is set within the communities of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, and I asked her if she saw Gadugi at work in any of the familial relationships she writes about. I've always thought Gadugi requires a conscious higher purpose, the realization that we're all in this together, and an extension beyond family bonds. This book is about Charlie Soap, but it is also about Gadugi. In the 2013 movie Cherokee Word for Water, the actor Moses Brings Plenty plays the role of Charlie Soap. In one scene, Wilma and Charlie are speaking at a community meeting, one like so many I covered as a reporter for the Cherokee Advocate. We see Charlie trying to articulate why a full-blood Cherokee community, a community that state and county officials had long written off as lazy and hostile, should come together to build a water line. An old man in the audience speaks up and asks if what Charlie means is Gadugi. In Cherokee, the intonation of the word can sound like the Cherokee word for bread. Was Charlie describing bread? After all, dinner had been served. Or was he speaking about an ancient concept of working together to help everyone? Charlie responds that he's not talking about bread. He is talking about work. This invites chuckles from the closely gathered Cherokees. They understood that the elder was teaching the young Charlie Soap a lesson, the meaning of Gadugi, collective work for the common good. Robin Wall Kimmerer, the Potawatomi author of Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants, writes that generosity is simultaneously a moral and a material imperative. In her tribe's language, Minidiwak means they give from the heart. She reminds us of a Haudenosaunee Iroquois pledge of allegiance to gratitude, including this tribute to the many tributaries of water. We give thanks to all of the waters of the world for quenching our thirst, for providing strength and nurturing life for all beings. We know its power in many forms, waterfalls and rains, mists and streams, rivers and oceans, snow and ice. We are grateful that the waters are still here and meeting their responsibility to the rest of creation. Can we agree that water is important to our lives and bring our minds together as one to send greetings and thanks to the water? Now our minds are one. Like Manitowoc in Potawatomi, Aloha in Hawaiian, and Ubuntu in Swahili, Gadugi inspires and informs community action. Gadugi became Charlie's purpose, and its principle was manifested through community development initiatives designed to bring clean drinking water to underserved populations in the hills of northeastern Oklahoma. In her book, Making a Difference, OU Press, the first woman to ever head the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs, Ada Deer, wrote about a meeting held in April 1994 at President Clinton's White House. The meeting focused on Native American trust lands. She remembered that Wilma presided over this gathering. Wilma had campaigned for Deer during her 1992 run for Congress. Soon after the White House event, Deer adjourned to the Interior Department for a meeting about a water project out west. The first responsibility, she wrote, for the use and management of tribal land is water rights. In popular culture, the Hollywood film The Big Short, starring Steve Carell, Christian Bale, Ryan Gosling, and Brad Pitt, ends with its hero, Michael Burry, focused on one commodity, water. The author, Alex Prudhomme, told the New York Times Book Review that the one subject he wished more authors would write about is water. We can survive without oil, but not without water. For Cherokees, as in many Native cultures, water is not only life, it is sacred. It is healing. It nourishes body and soul. As such, it is not just respected, it is revered. In Cherokee tradition, Ama Atiyi is a word that conveys both water and the life within it. There, below a spring, river, or well, live Ama Atiyi, one or two tiny specimens that ensure the water is safe. As long as they are there, the water will be there. If the Ama Atiyi are not respected, however, they will leave, and with them the well will go dry. Disrespect the water by throwing trash in it, or disrespect it by locating a polluting pipeline nearby, and Ama Atiyi will leave. And with the departure of the sacred Ama Atiyi, life-giving, soul-nourishing water will go too. Introduction. This is the story of Charlie Soap. The Wikipedia version of his life states that he was Wilma Mankiller's husband. That is true. But his story, and his meaning to the story of Wilma and of the Cherokee Nation, drills much deeper. To many, he is a warrior for Cherokee communities. For me, he was also the lead character of the first news stories I reported between 1983 and 1986. Over the decades, since the 1980s, he became a beloved friend and a mentor. Although this is also the story of Wilma Mankiller, her own books and those of other writers have already chronicled the chief's exceptional, inspirational life. She now graces the currency of the United States of America. On one side of the ubiquitous quarter dollar is George Washington. On a commemorative coin issued as part of the American Women Quarters program, Wilma Mankiller is on the other. If only it were Charlie Soap's profile instead of George's. In Cherokee Wolf Clan culture, Wilma represented the front of the pack, setting direction and pace. This leadership is crucial, but insufficient. Charlie was the rear guard, serving and leading from the back of the pack. Together, Wilma and Charlie reinvented community development for Native Americans and reignited the willpower of the Cherokee people by doing one seemingly simple thing. They listened to the poorest of the poor. They heard their pleas for the most basic human need, water, and they worked alongside their communities to solve problems that had spanned generations. America has a drinking water problem, the Wall Street Journal reported on its front page as the fall of 2022 began. Throughout that first week of September, the nation turned its attention to Jackson, Mississippi, a predominantly African-American city with no safe drinking water. "This is unbearable," one Jackson citizen told reporters. She was not alone in holding that opinion. It turns out that every 2 minutes there's a new crack somewhere in the country's buried water pipe system, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. Charlie Soap and Wilma Mankiller's story related to water began in the 1980s and resounds even today. To locate where our story takes place, the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, picture the geographic middle of the United States. Find Oklahoma City and trace your finger up and to the right, toward the point where Oklahoma, Arkansas, Kansas, and Missouri come together. That little corner of northeast Oklahoma would send an important message of Native American self-determination to the world. My own life, as a white man born and raised in Indian country, provides something of a backstory. Together, this is the unlikely tale of two men from different worlds with common goals, two men who deeply wanted to understand each other's lives and perspectives. Not only that, we are two people who want to share, perhaps even to educate, our respective communities about each other. In 1984, when I joined the Cherokee Advocate newspaper, I was 20 years old. In my own youthful mind, I was an experienced journalist, having already worked for two dailies and two school newspapers. Truth is, what I lacked in experience, a lot, I made up for with enthusiasm, a lot more. I wanted to be a writer more than anything in the world. Before I landed in Tahlequah, the Tulsa World had given me, then a high school student, a shot as a contributing reporter, a stringer, as the job was called in those days. Later, the weekly college newspaper paid me with work-study stipends. Eventually, the Tahlequah Daily Press, then the Pictorial Press, paid $200 a week, a small fortune for which both the editor and publisher were incredibly demanding, given that I was also going to school full-time. The Advocate offered a nice balance, an afternoon, evening, and weekend schedule, decent pay, and an editor whom I had worked with before and adored, Lynn Howard. The newspaper offered me something else, too, something I would grow to appreciate more and more every year of my life, an opportunity to work alongside people and a culture that would shape me and my worldview. I attended Northeastern State University, NSU, which is reportedly the first college west of the Mississippi. When it opened in 1851 as the Cherokee National Female Seminary, its mission was to train teachers. It soon opened a seminary for men. A quarter of the student body today is Native American, and the school has updated its mascot since I attended. NSU is no longer the Red Men, but the Riverhawks, a tribute to the nearby Illinois River. I arrived at NSU in the summer of 1982. After graduating from Broken Arrow High School, about an hour and a half away. I spent my junior and senior year in Broken Arrow, living with my dad and stepmom. But in the years before that, my mother, brother, and I had moved once, twice, even three times per year, every year, since I was in the third grade. Along the way, we experienced homelessness, hunger, domestic violence, sexual assault, and just general anxiety because of our difficult circumstances. That's a different story, but it is relevant because those circumstances were also those that I was about to cover as a reporter in the Cherokee Nation. In college and in my journalism, I was asking some hard questions about poverty. What is the role of government? What is the role of the church? What are families capable of solving, and what are they not capable of solving? What is a caring community of people? A few miles down the road from my college campus sits Sequoia High School, one of America's Indian boarding schools. It was founded in 1871 as the Cherokee Orphan Asylum to care for children, including those who had lost their parents in the Civil War, yet another tragic period for the Cherokee. Over the years, the school ebbed and flowed, sometimes under federal control, sometimes under tribal control, with the undulations of American Indian policy. Regardless, it was always a tough place. Adjacent to Sequoia, with its giant water tower looming high on a hill like a never-setting moon, is the headquarters of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. Shortly after the new year began in 1984, I walked in the front door of the seven-sided building for my first day of work. Upon entering, to the right I saw the grand chambers of the Tribal Council, which I would cover monthly on Saturday mornings for the next several years. To the left was the executive branch, the offices of the principal chief and the deputy principal chief. Our little newsroom was located in between the council and the executive wings. The dark room where staff photographer Sammy Still and I developed and printed innumerable black and white photos was just past the council chamber. It was a good place to hide from critics and deadlines. Today, nearly 40 years later, I've stacked a large table in my basement with the notebooks, memos, photos, grant applications, handwritten diaries, and every issue of the Cherokee Advocate that I worked on from 1984 to 1986, including supplements and special programs. Somehow, despite endless moves, personal disasters, and a long career, I have held on to these precious items like gemstones. Back then, the Advocate had no bylines and no photo credits, but the staff was listed in a tidy little box on page 2. I remember the stories I wrote, and I still recognize the writing of others. Leafing through the pages, I can see my passion, but also my early clunkiness and naivete. The photos I took are well-framed, but often poorly lit, poorly printed, or both. Each month we produced the newspaper in a way that was at once cutting-edge and on the verge of becoming obsolete. The 1980s did away with the old linotype machines and ushered in phototypesetting or cold type. We wrote our stories with IBM Selectric typewriters, turned them in for editing, and then typeset them on an enormous CompuGraphic machine, which in turn produced typeset copy on a film to be sliced up with X-Acto knives, waxed and pasted up on large sheets of layout paper. Huddled over a light table, we wrote headlines, sized holes for photographs, and left notes in margins for the printer. CompuGraphic would go out of business by 1988, when desktop publishing from Apple and Microsoft replaced the laborious process with a simple, computerized interface. Desktop publishing itself was replaced by the internet and websites by the late 1990s. The history of the newspaper that employed me was so deeply part of the person I had become that I dedicated a semester-long paper in college, Journalism 3533, to the history of Cherokee news reporting. The Advocate is recognized as the resumption of the historic Cherokee Phoenix, the first tribal newspaper in the United States. The Phoenix began in 1828. It ceased publication in 1834, a few years before the Trail of Tears. According to the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, an estimated 16,000 Cherokees were forced to undertake the 6 to 7 month journey to Indian territory in the land beyond Arkansas. Between the stockades, starvation, and sickness, and the harsh winter conditions, as the National Park Service once put it, some 4,000 Cherokees perished, never reaching their new land. I include background on Cherokee journalism here because of the crucial role it played in my front row seat to this historic era. The Advocate was the first newspaper to be printed in Indian Territory. Experts often refer to the Trail of Tears as a genocide because of its systematic removal of Native Americans and their culture. When it ended, the Cherokee people grieved and determined to rebuild. They needed a seat for the new tribal government. The name of the city of Tahlequah, Tahlequah, the tale goes, is Cherokee for two is enough. It was said that two clan chiefs proclaimed the settlement west of the Illinois River the new capital, even though the other chieftains never showed up. It was centrally located for the new nation. Housing and health were the first priorities. Education and governance followed closely behind. On September 26, 1844, a year and 1 month after its authorization by the Cherokee National Council, the first issue of The Advocate rolled off its new press, 63 years before Oklahoma statehood. The Advocate ended its run in the 1990s, and the Phoenix arose once again. The Phoenix and The Advocate have traded off, one and then the other, as the official tribal newspaper. I remember sitting in a pleasant archive in Park Hill, Oklahoma, researching the history of Cherokee journalism, the result of which is included in the appendix. I read pile after pile of old, brittle newspapers, no latex gloves required, just me and the history of a nation. A passerby would hardly know it now, but that wooded hamlet of Park Hill played a dramatic role in Cherokee history and culture in the new lands of Oklahoma. Chief John Ross, who resisted removal during his nearly four decades as principal chief, is buried here. Elias Boudinot, the newspaper editor who acquiesced, lived, and was assassinated here for signing the Treaty of New Echota, which led to the Trail of Tears. As a young journalist in the 1980s, I used to sit, as I said, in the Cherokee Nation Historical Society's archives in Park Hill, browsing original copies of The Advocate and Phoenix. The research paper I later turned in for academic credit told the story of a cast of colorful Indian and non-Indian characters involving tribal politics and U.S. government policies. I found the Cherokee paper to be pro-South during the Civil War. Like the United States, the Cherokee Nation was bitterly divided. Wealthy Cherokees held slaves. Tragic and immoral, but not unlike their white neighbors in Georgia, Tennessee, and the Carolinas. I cannot reconcile this. The Cherokee Advocate and the Cherokee Phoenix were the ultimate hyper-local papers, reporting the story of a people and their well-being. The papers were constantly asking, what will become of us Cherokees? What is the fate that awaits us? The Advocate survived political pressures, fires, and budget cuts. Rereading my youthful report, I am struck now by my belief that the papers should be digitized for future researchers. My reporting began with what sounded like a basic assignment, to cover the building of water lines. I soon learned it was not so basic. A water line is critical infrastructure that is both an engineering feat and a demonstration of political will. Infrastructure requires land, labor, and capital. Water lines, power lines, fiber optic cable, each is buried unseen and yet essential to life today. A water line cannot deliver water from its source, a lake or reservoir or river, to your kitchen faucet if there is a gap or a break in it. Those gaps were where the people of the Cherokee Nation lived. Think of the road to your home. If the street that leads to your driveway is closed for repairs, or lack of repairs, you can't get your car from where you are stranded to where you want to be, home. Traffic, internet service, gas, electricity, water, they all rely on seamless connectivity. That seamless connectivity is precious and comes at great expense. The metaphor of dangerous gaps also works well for understanding the Native American experience in contemporary times. There are a lot of gaps in the average American's understanding. Let's start with population. About 2.6% of Americans, 8.1 million people.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?